Well, good morning, everybody. Oh, man, this is so weird. I don't know if you feel like this is so weird if you're sitting at home right now on a Sunday morning and not here at the church building, but I'm here at the church building, and it is empty, and this is so strange. And I'll tell you, I'm already missing all of you. We live in a crazy time right now. And if you're joining us for the first time, or if you're joining us and you're sitting on the couch and you're going, what in the world? I'm right there with you. But we're so glad that you're joining us this morning. And I'm just excited to talk with you this morning because, you know, this is such a distracting time in our lives. And it's so easy to take our focus off what is important and what is real. And I'm just so thankful that this morning we can turn our eyes back to Jesus. And that's what I want to do with you this morning. And to do that, I need to start off by talking about this idea of what we would call maybe bad leadership. I think we've all either have been under or knew someone who was under or watched someone from a distance who was experiencing bad leadership. Whether that's at work, whether that's with a government official, whether that's on a sports team or even in the home, I think we can all identify bad leadership when we see it. What makes bad leadership so bad isn't necessarily just the incompetence issue, right? And I think we've all dealt with that. Have you ever had to work for someone who really didn't know what they were doing? And all you Centerville Grace staff, don't raise your hands at home. But if you've ever been in that position, you know how frustrating it can be, and you might have wondered how can a person like that ever get into a position like that? Because let's be honest, for those of us who've had bosses, most of us think that we could probably have do a better job, at least at some parts of their job. And there are times when you're thinking they don't even know what they're doing. They're just kind of making this stuff up as they go. And for those of us who are in leadership positions, who are managers, who are bosses, our biggest fear is sometimes, I think, to have people find out, yeah, we really don't know what we're doing. We are kind of making this stuff as we go. I mean, just this whole virus thing, this is uncharted waters, and we don't really know what we're doing all the time. But for those of us who have to work under someone who maybe lack the skill or lack the aptitude, the decision-making, it's hard for us. So incompetence is one thing. I would say if someone lacks the aptitude or lacks the ability, I wouldn't call that bad leadership as much as I would say that's poor leadership or ineffective leadership. But when I talk about bad leadership, I'm talking about the kind of leaders who basically disregard their impact on those who are under them. I'm talking about the kind of leadership that really is only about the leader. I'm talking about the kind of leadership that it's only about either gaining power or staying in power. And the idea is they're going to take advantage of people just so they can get ahead. Have you ever had to work for someone like that? I mean, not only is it frustrating, but it's scary because at some point you realize they don't really care about you. You're simply a means to their end. And because of that, you're easily replaceable. And when your livelihood is on the line, or when your freedoms are on the line, or when your reputation is on the line, when your children's futures are on the line, that can be a scary place to be. So leaders are supposed to put themselves second. They're supposed to be a servant leader, to put the other person first, but that doesn't always happen. In fact, I don't have any stats to back this up, but it seems like there's never a shortage of bad leadership, whether in our country or culture or throughout history. I think in some ways it just kind of comes with the territory. In fact, you've probably heard this quote before. Power tends to corrupt, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. That was a quote given by a man named John Dalberg Acton. But that was just part of his quote. He would go on to say, great men are almost always bad men, even when they exercise influence and not authority. Still more when you superadd the tendency or the certainty of corruption by authority. In other words, it just seems like that's the case. That comes with the territory. So if you look through the annals of history, it seems like most, if not all, generations has to deal with the idea of bad leadership in some way or another. And Israel was no exception. Israel, although they were supposed to be different as God's chosen people, they were not different. Israel struggled from the very beginning as a nation to find good leadership, both religiously and politically. From the time of the first king to the time of the King of Kings, I mean, bad leadership had taken its toll on the nation of Israel. In fact, by the time Jesus steps on the scene, Rome was in charge over a relatively small nation of people known as the Jews. But not only that, but the religious establishment in the Israel, in the nation of Israel, that was made up of priests, high priests, Pharisees, teachers of the law, Sadducees, they still had great influence over the people. And even though they understood and knew exactly what it meant to be under the thumb of bad leadership, they did little to practice their leadership any differently. Now, one other thing that you need to know before we read Jesus' next claim about himself is that you need to understand that because Israel's roots were in many ways nomadic or agrarian in nature, Israel would often describe their leaders as shepherds. See, for most of Israelites, for most of their history, this was a very familiar image, this idea of shepherding. From Abraham to Moses to King David, oftentimes their key leaders were actually at one point in their lives shepherds. And this became the unofficial metaphor for Israel's leaders. In fact, when God was upset with Israel's leaders, this is the imagery that he would use. For example, the prophet Ezekiel. I'm going to read from Ezekiel 34, starting in verse 1. Here's what God says. It says, "The word of the Lord came to me." This is what Ezekiel is writing. "Son of man, prophesy against the shepherds of Israel. Prophesy and say to them, this is what the sovereign Lord says. Woe to you, shepherds of Israel, who only take care of yourselves." Now, let me just pause for a second. I don't think he's really talking about shepherds. I don't think God has a problem with the actual shepherds in Israel. This is just a metaphor, again, for the leaders of Israel. He says, "Should not shepherds take care of their flock?" Well, it's like, of course. "You eat the curds, clothe yourselves with the wool, and slaughter the choice animals, but you do not take care of the flock. You have not strengthened the weak or healed the sick or bound up the injured. You have not brought back the strays or searched for the lost. You have ruled them harshly and brutally." Verse 5. "So they were scattered because there was no shepherd. And when they were scattered, they became food for all the wild animals. My sheep wandered over all the mountains and on every hill. They were scattered over the whole earth, and no one searched or looked for them." And so you see, this is a scathing indictment of the Jewish leadership that. And it continues verse after verse. And then finally, here's what God says he's going to do in light of or in response to such bad leadership of Israel. Ezekiel 34:11. "For this is what the sovereign Lord says. I myself will search for my sheep and look after them. As a shepherd looks after his scattered flock when he is with them, so will I look after my sheep." Now there's two very important word pictures given here. First of all, who does God say will become their shepherd? God says, "I will be your shepherd." In fact, later on in this chapter, he says in Ezekiel 34:23, "I will place over them one shepherd, my servant David, and he will tend them, and he will tend them and be their shepherd." So in one sense, God says, "I will shepherd," but then he goes on to say, "Well, I'm going to give you a shepherd, my servant David," who obviously isn't King David. He's long since passed away, but someone from the line of David will be their shepherd. So the Jews took this to mean there's going to be a future Messiah, one who was of God, from God, somehow connected to God, who would eventually come and lead Israel. But the other interesting, at least for me, imagery is the idea that God calls his people not just sheep, but his sheep. And again, you can find this imagery just like shepherds all throughout the scriptures, both the Old Testament and New Testament. Now, as many of you know, having God call you sheep is like receiving a backhanded compliment. It's like when someone says to you, "You're not as dumb as you look." Has anybody ever said that? Hopefully not. But how do you respond to that? "You're not as dumb as you look." Well, thank you? I don't know. To be likened to sheep was, in some ways, a total insult. Sheep are, in fact, as many of you know, the most helpless of all animals. They can actually, I just discovered this, they can actually get stuck on their back. And if you go and, you know, pause this and go and Google sheep stuck on back, I mean, you can find all sorts of kind of funny videos, but sheep who are either overweight or are pregnant can actually get on their back and cannot roll back over. That's how helpless sometimes sheep can be. And I'll talk a little bit more about next week with this idea of sheep, but God calls us sheep, and that's not a compliment. But what is a compliment is what, and what is uplifting, is that he says, you are my sheep. We are called his sheep, or my sheep, he says. And as we're going to see, God as a shepherd radically cares for his sheep. And that's what I want to talk to you about this morning. In fact, if you haven't been with us in this series, if you haven't kind of walked through the last couple weeks with us, we've been in a series called I Am, and we're looking at the seven very audacious claims that Jesus made about himself. And last week, we looked at Jesus' claim as he was standing in the temple courts at the last night of the Feast of Tabernacles. And if you don't understand the significance of that moment, you really need to go back and listen to last week's talk. But Jesus stands up and he declares in front of everyone, he says, I am the light of the world. And in a very poignant way, he would go from there, and John tells us, who's writing all this, he tells us he finds a man who was born blind. In other words, he's never been able to see. He couldn't tell you what a tree looks like. He couldn't tell you the difference between red and blue. I mean, he's been walking in the dark his entire life. And here Jesus comes, the self-proclaimed light of the world. And he comes to him, and John tells us he gives him his sight for the very first time. And as you can imagine, it is by far the greatest day for this man's life. And yet John tells us that the Pharisees, the shepherds, the leaders of Israel, were not only not excited for this man, that eventually they would hurl insult after insult at him, and then they would throw him out of the local synagogue, basically excommunicating him from his faith community, which was a big deal in that culture. And when Jesus found out about how this man was treated, who did obviously nothing wrong, was just claiming he was healed by Jesus. I mean, that's all he knew, that this Jesus fellow healed him. And when Jesus found out how he was treated by Israel's leaders, he had something to say in response to their bad leadership. And it's in this context that he makes the next big, very bold, very audacious I Am statement. So if you have your Bibles, turn with me to John chapter 10, verse 1. Very truly I tell you, Pharisees, anyone who does not enter the sheep pen by the gate, but climbs in by some other way, is a thief and a robber. So Jesus gives them almost kind of like a little parable or story, right? He's hot and bothered, but yet he still goes into this story mode. He says, let me explain to you how the whole sheep shepherding thing work. And of course, these guys, I mean, who grew up all around shepherds, they were everywhere. They knew how the whole shepherding thing worked, but Jesus is making a point. And Jesus says this, that sheep are often kept in a community pen. Right, you need to understand, back in that day, it was not uncommon, in fact, for a number of different flocks to be kept in one pen. It was just more economical, you know, to build one large pen and have multiple flocks come and stay in there for the night. Kind of like what we do with our cars when we come to church, or when we used to come to church, right? We don't all have separate garages here at the church, or even personal parking spaces. We all kind of share the same parking pen, so to speak. And that's what they did with sheep back in that day. So the sheep would be out grazing during the day, and the shepherd would lead them back to the village where this community pen would be. And as they walked into this pen, he would check them, each one, to make sure they were all numbered and healthy. And they would stay there for the night as a place of protection. But during the night, Because sheep are so helpless, if there was no one watching or if the thief was just a good thief, someone could kind of come in, jump the fence, grab the sheep, slit its throat, and carry it away. And of course, anyone who does that does not care about the sheep. Just by the nature of how they come in, how they demonstrate, they don't belong here just by jumping the fence. And of course, this is Jesus' indictment to the Pharisees. And if you're wondering, that the sheep pen in this story really represents the nation of Israel. And the thieves and the robbers represent the self-appointed Jewish leaders who were, in a sense, fleecing their own people. They only used and abused the sheep. But Jesus then would say, in contrast, in verse 2, the one who enters by the gate is the shepherd of the sheep. Now, Jesus doesn't say it yet, but in a moment, and we're going to actually look at this more next week, but he later calls himself the shepherd, right? So Jesus is the shepherd. But he says, the one who enters by the gate is the shepherd of the sheep. Verse 3, the gatekeeper opens the gate for him because, of course, he has the right credentials and the authority, and the sheep listen to his voice. The sheep know the voice of the shepherd, and although there were multiple flocks in one pen, sheep knew the shepherd's call. In the morning, and this actually happens, the shepherd comes in through the gate and will give a call to his sheep. And I don't know what the call would be, and I'm not even going to try to make one. But the sheep hear the shepherd's voice, recognize it, and they start heading out because they know his voice. Second half of verse 3 says, and he calls his own sheep by name and leads them out. Now, two very important points I want to stop and make about this. First of all, check out, he says he leads them out. And this is one difference between Western shepherding and Eastern shepherding. Western shepherding, we're used to seeing people on horses getting behind their livestock and driving them in certain direction from behind. Whereas Eastern shepherding is much different. They call and lead from the front, and the sheep follow. And the meaning is Jesus is calling the people of Israel out of and into his own flock. And here is why this is so important. Here's what he's saying. Is when you begin to trust Jesus, Jesus is right there with you. So you need to understand, when Jesus calls you to himself, when you become a Jesus follower, he doesn't give you a map and say, here, follow this. Here's the treasure map. Just follow this to get to the treasure. No, he says, follow me. I'm right there with you. And you might say, well, what if I make a mistake? Jesus says, I'm still right there with you. He's leading you to himself. He's there even when you don't feel like he's with you. If you are his, he's leading you, whether you see his hand or not. But the other important point, and check this out, is that Jesus says he calls his own sheep by name. And if you understand the metaphor, this is powerful because it's here that he begins to push the metaphor. It wasn't common for shepherds to name each individual sheep. It wasn't as if, you know, the shepherds come up to the gate and say, well, here Donner and here Vixen and here Lamb Chop. That didn't happen. But Jesus pushes the metaphor because he's really not talking about shepherding. He's talking about his relationship to his followers. And he says he names them. He calls them by name. And especially in the Old Testament, a name was much more than just a label. A name meant status. A name meant significance. If you remember the story of the Tower of Babel, those who wanted to build this great tower did so. Why? Because they wanted to make a name for themselves. See, a name meant significance. But not only that, a name meant mission. God called Abraham out and changed his name to Abraham because he was going to be a father of multitudes. Jesus took Simon and changed his name to Peter after he made this declaration about Jesus. It meant mission. It meant going out. But not only that, having a name meant having a distinctiveness. And I think parents understand this today. Parents are always trying to help their kids, you know, become unique and set apart. So parents today will name their kids some pretty unusual names like Apple or Cinnamon or Cheerios. That sounds like a good combination. Apple, Cinnamon, Cheerios, that sounds good this morning. But what Jesus alludes to here, and there's plenty other places where this is talked about, but when you become a follower of Jesus, I want you to understand, in a way, he names you. He calls you by name. In other words, he gives you your significance, he gives you your mission, and he gives you your identity and distinctiveness. See, in a world where we look for those things from our spouses, from our spouse, from our parents, from our work, from our appearances, Jesus says, no, you can't find those things there. Listen to my voice, he'd say. I will name you. I will call you by name. You find those things from me and me only. He knows our name. See, one of the things that we work hard here at Centerville Grace is we want to get to know your name. When someone knows you by name, we think that that's important. There's a level of intimacy and connectedness that you feel when someone knows your name. I love to say, instead of saying, hey man, or hey there, I could say, hey Bob, or hey Cindy. It's nice when people know your name. And we don't like to admit this, but let's be honest, it kind of hurts when people don't remember our names. I actually have this running joke. I got to get this off my chest. I have this running joke with my best friend who's also a pastor in our network of churches. There's a wife of a former pastor who still is in leadership in our fellowship. And so from time to time, we bump into this ex-pastor's wife. Now, I have spent significant time with this woman because her kids and I went to the same college and hung out. We were friends. I was over to their home several times. I went fishing with my friends and their mom, this woman, on their boat. I have run into her on several occasions. I used to go to the same church as her during my college years. There have been countless times that we have spent time together and had interactions together. And yet still to this day, this just actually happened a couple months ago, every time I see this woman, I have to walk up and she looks at me with a blank face and I introduce myself to her as if this was the very first time meeting. And it's only after I say, hi, my name is Dave, that she remembers that we have met before. She'll introduce herself every time if I don't. And it's just so weird. And it's not that she has a memory disorder. She remembers everybody else's name, including my best friend's name, yet she doesn't remember my name every single time. And I used to be really insulted by this, but over time it just became more of a joke now. But it did hurt at first. But don't miss what Jesus is trying to say here. Jesus, the Son of God, the Shepherd of Heaven, check this out, he knows you by name, and he doesn't forget. He knows you. Jesus goes on, verse 4, when he has brought out all his own, he goes on ahead of them, and his sheep follow him because they know his voice. But they will never follow a stranger. In fact, they will run away from him because they do not recognize a stranger's voice. Jesus is saying, my sheep know the difference between when I speak to them and when someone else speaks to them. They know who to listen to and who not to listen to. They know the difference between the true shepherd and false shepherds and false leaders. And on Jesus goes with this whole shepherding analogy. In fact, John tells us there here in verse 6, Jesus used this figure of speech. He wasn't being literal, of course. He's used this figure of speech, but the Pharisees did not understand what he was telling them, which is, of course, ironical, because they were supposed to be the ones, right, who were supposed to understand who God is. They were supposed to understand everything and all things God, but here they were, in the sense, the blind ones. They are now more blind than the blind man who was healed. So Jesus, understanding this, tries again. Verse 7, John tells us, therefore Jesus said again, very truly, I tell you, and here's where our next I am statement comes. He says, I am the gate. Some of your translations may have door. I am the gate or the door for the sheep. Now, what is Jesus talking about? See, oftentimes, there was no physical gate for these pens. So the shepherd himself would sit in the doorway, acting as the door or the gate. And this would ensure the sheep were protected. No one or no thing could come in, and no one or no thing could go out except through the shepherd, because he was the gate. Now, doors and gates are still today a symbol of protection. See, what do we do every night? Well, what I do every night is I make sure our doors, garage door, front door, back door, all the doors are shut and locked. They provide that sense of real physical protection, not just from bad guys, but even from the elements. We shut the door because it's cold outside. But not only do they provide a physical protection, doors provide emotional protection. See, I don't know about you, but I can't fall asleep unless I know for sure the doors are shut and locked. Like, there's sometimes when I'm like, did I shut the door? Did I lock the door? And I'm laying in bed for a minute, and then it goes 2 minutes and 5 minutes. I'm like, I just better go check. And I go check, and, you know, sure enough, chances are I've already locked the door. And when I lock the door, ain't nobody getting in, because we got some pretty heavy-duty door locks at our place. And you can sleep, and you can rest, and you can be at peace. In fact, my kids are all young, and every night they ask us, would you please, Mom and Dad, would you please, one of you, at least sit outside our door, right? For some reason, this provides so much comfort for them. That if we just sit outside the door, and we have this small upstairs area where basically if we sit next to the steps, everyone can see from their room, we're sitting there. And yes, as parents, it is absolutely annoying for us, but they love it because it provides this emotional security for them that someone is standing guard outside their door. Jesus says, I'm a shepherd like that. I'm right here with you. I'm on watch. You don't have to fear. You don't have to be afraid. Nothing's going to happen to you without my authorization, because I'm the gate. And then he slams all the false spiritual leaders that came before him, in a sense. All who have come before me are thieves and robbers, but the sheep have not listened to them. And then Jesus reiterates himself, verse 9, I am the gate. It's like, well, what do you mean by that? Whoever enters through me, he says, will be saved. This right here is such a huge claim. Jesus looks at the Pharisees, the man who was born blind and now healed, his disciples like John who were standing there. He looks at this whole crowd of people and he says, you cannot find salvation except through me. Can we just agree this morning or whenever you listen to this? This is such a big claim and a big promise. Jesus is what he's saying here. Jesus is claiming to be our access to God. That you cannot get to God without Jesus. You see, this is why we make such a huge deal about Jesus here at Grace. Because we believe Jesus' words, that whoever enters through me will be saved. Now, I know some of you may say, wow, that sounds incredibly exclusive. Because in a sense, it is. There is no other door to heaven. There is no other way to God. Jesus is it. But the good news is the gate is open to all those willing to surrender their lives to him. Have you done that? Have you done that? Have you bowed your knee to the shepherd who watches over his flock? who allows people to enter into the kingdom of God. But it must come through him. There is no other way. Notice what Jesus says next. End of verse 9. They will come in and go out and find pasture. See, this is the thing about doors. Doors aren't just one way. I mean, they may swing one way, but doors, when you open a door, they're both for coming and going. Anybody ever like to save big money at Menards? Save big money at Menards, right? I have a little beef with Menards. I can't stand the way they're set up, that their entrance is so far away from their exit doors. And so when you pull into the parking lot, you got to decide, do I park near the front door and then I have to walk so much further when I leave their exit doors to get back to the car, or do I park near the exit and take a long walk to the entrance, or do I park somewhere in the middle to make, you know, the difference up? It's frustrating. So what I ended up doing is I just park at the exit. I walk in through the exit doors because I'm such a rebel. Because I believe doors are for both coming and going. And here's what Jesus is saying with this. He says, I am the gate in two different ways. And don't miss this. I am the gate, meaning I am where you find ultimate protection and ultimate safety and ultimate security. Jesus isn't promising us bad things won't happen to you. In fact, he's promised the opposite. But what he does promise is that no one will be able to ultimately harm you. No one will be able to take away what Jesus gives to you. In fact, John 10:28, Jesus would later say this, I give them eternal life, and they shall never perish. In fact, he says, no one will snatch them out of my hand. You see, you can rest assured of your salvation, that once you surrender your life to Jesus, your shepherd watches over you, and no one will snatch you out of his good hand. But notice, it's not just a safety thing when it comes to gates. Notice again what he says at the end of verse 9. He says, they will come in and go out and find pasture. Jesus isn't meaning just that we are protected as the gate that he calls himself. Jesus is basically saying he's the means in which we move out into the world. Because Jesus is calling us out. He's calling us out of our old lifestyles, out of our old habits, out of our old beliefs. But how do we find strength to leave all that? Because it's difficult and scary. He becomes the way in which we do it. Only through Jesus do we find the strength, the power, the means, the boldness to move out into a world that is broken, that is filled with sin, that is evil, that is bent against God, and yet we can move out in strength and power and boldness because we have Christ with us. We move out through him. But not only that, notice he says to go out and find pasture. This kind of in and out and pasture. It's like, what do you mean, Jesus? I think Jesus is trying to say only in him will we find absolute and true freedom. You see, when we think of gates, oftentimes we think of restriction. It's designed to restrict. But I want you to understand gates provide incredible freedom. I want you to imagine for a second, There's a bunch of young children playing next to a cliff. But between the kids and the cliff, there's a giant fence, a big old fence, right? And so they're playing, but the cliff, you know, the cliff's not even, you know, an issue because the fence protects them. But imagine someone say, you know what, that fence is so restrictive, let's remove the fence. Are the children who are playing near the cliff, are they more free or less free? I think they're less free. Jesus is saying, I am the gate, but I offer you freedom that you can't have apart from me. You can be free of fear. How many of us would love to be free of fear, especially in times like this? Jesus says, when you come to me, when you understand who I am and what my job is, my role as your shepherd, you can go in and out and find pasture and find that freedom. I'm not here to restrict you. I'm here to provide for you and care for you. Jesus is our shepherd, and we're free to enjoy his good gifts. Let me just give an example. Wedding band on my finger here. A lot of you who are listening to this are married. Are you more free or less free because you're married? See, some people see marriage as like, oh, it's so restrictive. No. I have never felt more free in my life, free to enjoy God's good gift of my wife. I am so thankful for her. And when I look at my wedding ring, I don't think, oh boy, too bad I can't do this or this or that. I think, oh my goodness, Lord, thank you for my wife. I can enjoy things with my wife and levels of intimacy and friendship that I could not without being married to her, without this kind of commitment to her. So Jesus says, listen, guys, I'm not trying to restrict you as the gate. I'm trying to provide real freedom for you, real peace for you, real joy for you, that you can find pasture. Then Jesus makes this incredible statement. He says, and maybe you've heard this before in verse 10, the thief comes only to steal, kill, and destroy. Now the question is, who is this thief? Well, in the context, I would say the thief represents the Jewish leadership. Instead of acting godly, they were acting like the rest of the world. Jesus says, in fact, all who've come before me were thieves and robbers. So that's one way of looking at this text, that who are the thieves? Or it's really the people in the world, the leaders of the world of Israel. They were against their own people. They were working against them. So that's one way of looking at this. But we also know there's other things working against us, not just bad leadership. There's also our own sin nature working against us. As we all probably know, sin has a way of robbing us from things like our joy, from things like peace. Sin has a way of killing our relationships. Some of you could tell story after story of how your sin involved a death of a relationship somewhere along the line. And ultimately, we know that sin leads to our spiritual death. But perhaps the most common way this verse is taken is to talk about Satan himself. That the thief represents Satan, the father of lies, the one who helped usher in the fall. And make no mistake, folks, Jesus talked so much about Satan for Christ followers to understand he is the real deal. He's a real figure. He's a real being. And he has real goals. And his real goals are to destroy you and anything good in your life. So which one is it? Is it the world as the thief? Is it sin or is it Satan? And as you know, my answer is yes. There's all these things working against us. All these things that only want to steal, kill, and destroy. But folks, take heart. We have a good shepherd who is our gate. And our good shepherd is not like bad leaders who come only for themselves, who come only to steal, kill, and destroy. Jesus says, I've come for a different reason. Look at the second half of verse 10. I have come that they may have life and have it to the full. Guys, this is why Jesus came. He wants you to have a full life, an abundant life, a life filled with his joy, as we're going to talk about next week, a life filled with his peace, a life filled with his life in you. But you cannot have this kind of life without him. You can't. This was Jesus' claim. I am the gate. Do you believe that? Listen, if Jesus is the gate, then I want you to hear this. Those who are on the outside are, in fact, invited in. See, if you're listening online and not yet a Christ follower, we're so glad that you're listening. But I want you to hear not my voice this morning. I want you to hear the voice of Jesus, the Good Shepherd, calling to you. And he calls to us and says things like, if anyone is thirsty, let him come to me. Hear his voice this morning and respond. See, bad leaders are leaders who want something from you for themselves. Jesus came to give something to you. Jesus came not wanting something from you. He has everything for you, and he gave his life for you. Hear the voice of the shepherd calling you in to his flock and respond by faith. By trusting in him. If Jesus is the gate, then those who are on the inside, those who have accepted and received the call of the shepherd, are now called outward. Remember, Jesus is on mission, and Jesus calls us out to follow him on mission. And because we are free to love, and we are free to serve, and we are free to sacrifice, we can move out into this broken, this hopeless world with power, with boldness, with grace, with hope, and without fear. If Jesus is the gate, then we don't have to live in fear. Guys, these are fearful times we live in. We don't know what tomorrow holds. We don't. Things are changing seemingly almost on a daily basis. I mean, who knows what the next day's news is going to hold? It can be a very frightening time. I have no idea if we're going to be able to do church in 2 weeks, 5 weeks, 10 weeks, I have no idea how long this is going to last. I don't know if many of us are going to get this virus or not. I don't know what it's going to do to our economy. I have no idea. But I serve a God who knows and who holds the entire world in his hands. And I have a God who says, I want to be your shepherd. And I'm calling you by name. And I stand at the door, the gateway, and I'm watching over you. And yeah, there are thieves who will come and only are bent on stealing, killing, and destroying. But I want you to know, I have come for you that you may have life and have it to the full. Guys, I want you to rest well tonight. Not because your doors are locked. Not because you have food in the refrigerator. Not because you stocked up on toilet paper. I want you to sleep well tonight. I want you to go be at peace tonight. Because you're trusting in none of those things. But you're trusting in the shepherd who watches over you. Guys, I love you and I miss you already so much. It is an easy time to get distracted. I just invite you to turn your eyes back to Jesus. Spend maybe more time with him now than you've ever had before in your life. Rest in him. Trust him. Follow him. Follow him out into the mission field. There are going to be people without hope, without peace, without any sense of security these next few weeks. And you can point them to Jesus. And you can lead them to Jesus by loving them like Jesus loves you. Would you be willing to do that? I want to pray for us right now. I'm just going to pray, God, first for our country, for a nation that is restless right now. God, I pray, Lord, that you would protect this country from this virus. But God, if this is your sovereign will to allow this thing to continue to spread, God, I pray, Lord, that as Christ followers, that we would not be afraid, but we would be a light to this world. A light in a very dark time. And that we could serve and sacrifice in ways that bring you glory. God, I pray for those of us who are anxious, that you would calm us, give us your peace that surpasses all understanding. God, help us to think in such creative ways of how to continue our relationship with people, even though we can't physically be there with them. God, I thank you for the technology that we have today, that we can stream, that we can put up videos, we can text, we can call, we can email, we can set up group chats. I mean, we can do so much, God. We thank you that you've provided this for us, but give us creativity on how to use it well. God, help us to be faithful to you during this time. We thank you for your love. We thank you for the fact that you are our shepherd and you are the gate. And you have come to give us a full and abundant life. We pray all this in Jesus' precious name.